Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely,
if we're uncomfortable
absolutely
talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
We have to resolve that here in Buffalo, that from the tragedy, this tragedy will come hope and light and life. It has to.
We're here to help you heal. This is not just put up a memorial and we walk away. We're committed to helping you rise up once again.
Even in the pain that we're still experiencing, we feel a sense of hope and optimism for the future of this community and for where this community will go.
The harm done to this community generations ago was intentional. So we have to be intentional in our efforts to fix it.
In the days, weeks, and months after May 14th, 2022, the promises of a better future for Buffalo's East Side came rushing in almost as quickly and almost as abundantly as the tens of millions of dollars devoted to helping the community recover. 4 years later, many residents are still waiting to see results, or at the very least, to get a timeline for when those results might come. Today, in part three of Where Did the Money Go?, we'll conclude by looking at what has changed and what hasn't. We'll see how much of the funding set aside for specific purposes, organizations, or people actually got to where it was supposed to go. And we'll ask what could realistically come from the long-term investment plans now on the table, and what history tells us is unlikely to happen.
We have circled back to entities promising something while they may want to deliver, cannot deliver. And our communities, at a minimum, are worse off.
Those who suffered most from the attack have different visions for where the community should go next and different ideas about what accountability should look like. Some are demanding answers from the organizations that raised and received money in response to 514. Others are still waiting to see whether long-term plans will turn into something they can actually feel in their daily lives. Over the next hour, we'll follow the money, the promises, and the unanswered questions still shaping Buffalo's East Side. This is the space between promise and proof. I'm Ejaz Jasil, and this is What's Next.
Accountability, what does that look like? How are you going to hold somebody accountable? What are you going to do that's going to be different, that's going to help heal the community?
There's a Ghanaian principle called Sankofa that often resurfaces in Buffalo around May each year. It's rooted in the philosophy that we must look back and learn from the past so we can better understand what comes next. To make sense of the money that came after May 14th, we have to unpack the economic conditions that existed before it. Many of us already know that history, so I won't spend too much time here. But a few pieces of it are important to keep in mind because they'll come up again later.
Peyton Gendron did the studying. He studied America. He read about segregation. He read about home values. He read about food deserts. And what did he find? He found Buffalo, New York, and he found Jefferson Avenue.
Buffalo's East Side was never struggling by accident. For generations, Black residents were shaped by policies and decisions that limited where they could live, where capital flowed, what neighborhoods were invested in, and what kind of wealth families could build. The Kensington Expressway is one of the clearest examples. Its construction damaged Black neighborhoods, displaced homes and businesses, and weakened families' ability to build wealth through property. In recent years, that history has become especially visible. The billion-dollar Kensington Expressway project predated the May 14th mass shooting. However, government officials increasingly discussed it alongside the East Side's broader recovery, as part of a much larger conversation about disinvestment, structural harm, and what it would take to repair communities that have been divided long before the shooting.
My view is sometimes you can't carve out a better future until you right the wrongs of the past. And that's exactly what we're doing with the Kensington Expressway project.
In 2021, researchers at the University at Buffalo looked at the state of Black Buffalo over three decades and found little meaningful progress on some of the most basic measures of economic well-being: poverty, income, homeownership, and employment. Dr. Henry Taylor helped lead that work through The Harder We Run, a report that connects those outcomes to a long history of disinvestment in Black Buffalo.
We are an exploited and oppressed people that have always lived under horrendous conditions, have always been denied opportunities.
So when a racist attack targeted the Jefferson Avenue Tops, it did more than devastate a community already carrying grief. It exposed an economic reality that had been there long before the shooting. The closure of the area's only supermarket highlighted structural inequities that could only be attributed to the city itself. That's the context the post-514 money entered. Another thing to consider: those economic barriers and years of disinvestment have stalled a lot of progress that Eastside communities were promised over the years. That's why some residents like Dolores are hesitant to believe that the new 514 era projects will come to fruition.
Until everybody starts taking their responsibility and being accountable, it's nothing going to change. It's going to get worse. And I think it's intentional, personally, I do. Because this Jefferson been on a revitalization for 40 years. Really, 40 years. I mean, I was 20 years old. And I've lived here just about all my life.
She's not wrong. The so-called revitalization of Jefferson Avenue has been in the works for decades. The earliest reference that I could find was from an edition of The Spectrum, the University at Buffalo student newspaper, dated April 29th, 1974. Then in the 90s, there was the Jefferson Alive Renaissance Plan led by the group 50 Women with a Vision. In the early 2000s, there was UB's Maston District Neighborhood Plan. And in 2020, there was Jefferson Avenue Complete Streets, the framework for the Jefferson Avenue Streetscape Project, which just saw construction begin this March. Not to get off track, but my point is, residents of the East Side are no strangers to promised investments that only begin to manifest generations later, if at all. So when individuals and organizations with post-514 funding say it'll take time before residents see the results of their long-term community investment strategies, exactly how much time are we talking? Buffalo Together's plan spans 5 years, but as steering committee member Garnell Whitfield Jr. explained, the work to bring it to fruition doesn't follow a simple timeline.
So just getting into this overview of, I guess, the community's perception of the money. You know, people hear tens of millions of dollars and say, well, you know, us who are still living in the Jefferson Avenue area, we have nothing to show for. You know, what are you doing with the money? So as you said, because you're building something substantial with Buffalo Together, it's going to take time. Results are not going to be seen overnight. You know, how do you address these sorts of criticisms of they have this money, why don't we see them spending it?
I think education is a huge part of that, and, you know, operating in a transparent way and making sure that the community is aware of the plan and making sure that we have buy-in and support from them. And so that's work that we have to do. And that's going to be ongoing, and we have to build capacity within our own community, because this is actually a culture change. You know what I'm saying? You talked about, well, the millions of dollars that have come through the East Side and have not made an impact. And so people are aware of that. And you know, so they have a lack of trust, lack of hope even, for anything better than what they've seen. It's our job to make sure that we build trust and build capacity with them and build a relationship with them that builds confidence and allows them hope and dream again. And so that's going to happen over time.
Not only will it take time for Buffalo Together to implement their plan, it's going to take more money, a lot more, potentially over $500 million. As for expecting people to trust the process, some critics of Buffalo Together say they've had 4 years to build trust and relationships with the community, but that their plans for what they will do with the fund's remaining $6.1 million, which is growing in interest, don't explain how the money is being invested right now. That criticism speaks to a larger tension in post-514 recovery. The money was meant to respond to harm that was immediate, visible, and devastating. But many of the plans attached to that money are long-term, complicated, and still difficult for the public to track. Just weeks after the attack, Buffalo's recovery was already being discussed on a national stage through the lenses of grief, public safety, and economy.
We look at different channels. One of the first channels that we look at is consumer sentiment, or the way people in these communities feel about their economy, about local businesses. And we find in the months and years after a mass shooting, these become more pessimistic and negative.
In July 2022, a congressional subcommittee held a hearing called Thoughts and Prayers Are Not Enough, focused on how mass shootings can damage communities, local economies, and long-term growth.
This event has the potential to harm Buffalo's already economically disadvantaged Black community and further grow inequality.
The hearing drew attention to how the impact of a mass shooting can cause widespread devastation in a city, even beyond the immediately impacted neighborhood. Government leaders and economists discussed the role of public policy in determining how to help communities rebuild after being impacted by a catastrophic event.
Productivity is going down. People are missing work, missing days of work, and are less productive at work. So we need policy, public policy, to provide financial support, but also medical support, not only in the long, in the short run, but also potentially in the medium and long run, helping these communities financially and to provide them medical care.
The post-tragedy public funding we've seen in Buffalo, committed or contracted at the city, county, state, and federal levels, covered several areas. That money supported the 514 Memorial and Healing Center, expanded mental health services, and efforts to combat food insecurity. But was the net cast too broadly? Should the financial response have been more targeted? I discussed those questions with Dr. Craig Rogers, an associate professor of economics and finance at Canisius University, which is less than a mile from the Jefferson Avenue Top Supermarket. He's been with the university since 2001, and his research spans poverty analysis, economic development, population change, and more, giving him a close view of the area and what's changed since May 14th. But Rogers says the question isn't just whether the money was spent across different recovery efforts, it's whether public dollars meant for low-income communities are actually reaching those communities in ways that last, and whether anyone is held accountable when they don't.
The larger issue, how do we being the federal government, state government, the local government, ensure that funds that are supposed to be directed to low-income communities are delivered in a way that provide sustainable impact to these communities and that there's accountability and transparency? I think those are the larger issues that have plagued low-income communities. Again, setting aside the tragedy that increased the funding support, temporarily increased the funding support. That aside, we have systematic issues that predates this tragedy where funds that are targeted for low-income communities have been misappropriated, misused. The goals and objectives have not aligned with the needs of the community. And I unfortunately think this is symptomatic of that much larger, broader problem challenge. So I didn't answer your question because there isn't one response. There isn't one response. You know, what should the federal response be? What should the state response be? What should a local government response be? What should not-for-profit response? There isn't this cookie-cutter approach, I do not think.
And in a response this large, with money coming from government, corporate, and philanthropic sources, Rogers says coordination matters.
You would hopefully want all these entities to be at a minimum on the same page, not necessarily the same paragraph, because that's probably unrealistic, but we have to be on the same page though. You cannot be on page 17 and I'm on page 71.
Right.
That's problematic, right? We can both be on page 17. You may be on paragraph 2, I'm paragraph 4, and we can work on that. But if you're on page 17, I'm on page 71, that in and of itself is problematic.
That's actually, I think, a great analogy for the post-514 giving that we've seen. I think a lot of people are maybe within the same book. You know, the subject matter, the intent was the same, but not on the same page whatsoever. And that's why, you know, 4 years later, here we are kind of wondering, you know, what do we have to show for quite literally tens of millions of dollars that poured into not just the city of Buffalo, but specifically the East Side community, the victims, the survivors, African-American businesses, lots of funds to support lots of very specific things. So you did say, you know, something very important, which almost everyone I've spoken to had two words that keep coming up: accountability and transparency. To ensure this, especially when you're dealing with something like post-crisis fundraising and spending, what role do you think audits or outside evaluations play or should play?
In a perfect world, a very outsized role. But with nascent organizations that are led by personalities, because many of our community organizations are led by personalities. And many of these organizations led by personalities either lack or have limited organizational structure. They may not have bylaws. If they have bylaws, the bylaws may not be adhered to. I guess where I'm going with this is, if the organization is not functional, then the question of audits becomes moot.
That's been one of the main complications we've run into while looking at oversight of 514 funds. And it raises another concern. Communities already facing hardship, like Buffalo's East Side, can become especially vulnerable to exploitation when a significant amount of money is on the table. If the community isn't benefiting from the money being poured in, then the question becomes, who is?
It is a murky world we live in, and it speaks to, on the more sinister side, the profitability of poverty, where entities and people may exploit vulnerable communities for personal gain. And we see this played out not just in our communities, but other communities, but it is to some degree more vicious in our communities. Too often, the economics in our economic development, whether it's community economic development or neighborhood economic development, leaves out economics.
It's just a word used a lot of times without the real meaning being applied then.
Without, yes, yes, yes. And so I am always cautious when I hear entities talking about community economic development or neighborhood economic development. Is as an economist, I'm like, well, where's, I don't see the economics in this right here. And that doesn't mean the initiatives that are listed are not valuable, but our communities are plagued by market failure, which takes many, many forms. And many of the initiatives that are purported to be under neighborhood economic development, community economic development, doesn't address or even come close to addressing the underlying market failure issues. So from an academic side, I go, well, I can see why this was not successful. It never once attempted to address some of the underlying market failure issues. Well, it's probably not going to lead to the outcome that people are proposing, which long way of going, we need to guard against the negative implications of the profitability of poverty, of internal actors and external actors taking advantage of low-income, vulnerable communities for misguided purposes.
Dr. Rogers raises a good point. How effectively have post-514 proposals addressed underlying issues, and how can that progress be tracked? One major area to look at is food access. When Jefferson Avenue temporarily lost its only supermarket, public officials and community leaders framed the area as an opportunity zone for grocers to invest in a community that had both a market and a need for greater food access.
This will open the eyes of other supermarket executives, other corporate leaders, that there is a tremendous market in this community.
Unfortunately, the continued disinvestment 4 years after the mass shooting suggests that the market Brown said was there may have been seen, but still has yet to be served. This isn't lost on residents nor local businesses that want to help fill that gap, like the African Heritage Food Co-op.
A lot of promises were made to increase food access on the east side. Do you feel they've fallen flat, or do you find that there are more concentrated efforts after 514, since it really highlighted the scarcity of food resources?
I don't see it. I don't see a more concentrated effort. I'm not saying that it's falling flat, but I don't see. But because, look, if people are doing work, then some other things should happen. And people should be able to get food. TOPS has opened, since 514, after they did the reconstruction and the rededication. TOPS is open, but a lot of people are deathly afraid to even go in TOPS. And look, before 514, we had eight, what we would call traditional serving supermarkets in the city of Buffalo. And guess what? Today we still have eight. So where's the expansion? In a city of nearly 300,000 people, you have about a supermarket for every 30,000 people. I mean, do the math. This is not something that requires you to be you don't have to be an engineer or a rocket scientist to figure this out.
In addition to food access, housing was another area that came with a lot of promise and large figures, particularly within Governor Kathy Hochul's $50 million investment in Buffalo's East Side. The state has reported progress in some of its programs, including homeowner arrears assistance, serious home repairs, and down payment support for first-time buyers. The down payment assistance program was exhausted by early 2025, and NeighborWorks Community Partners reported completing 102 East Side home repair projects through the Buffalo East Homeownership Improvement Program. But what's harder to find is the bigger outcome picture. How many longtime East Side homeowners were kept in their homes? How many Black residents were able to become first-time homeowners? And whether these investments changed the larger housing conditions in the neighborhoods they were meant to stabilize? The broader $50 million announcement was framed as a response to the short and long-term needs of Buffalo's East Side after an anti-Black racist attack. But the housing programs themselves were not race-based. They were largely place-based, tied to target zip codes, income limits, homeownership status, and specific property needs. That makes it harder to determine whether the money primarily benefited the people it was meant to help, Black residents with deep roots on the East Side, rather than newcomers, outside buyers, or real estate interests drawn to the neighborhood after new investment was announced.
Everybody basically, except for two people, own their homes. Now we got a lot of renters, and now five of the houses are now owned. These houses have been vacant for 20 years, and the guy and they even did their thing, and they live there now. So, I'm pretty sure that people gonna get the money. But what, you know, the people that live there for 30 years, I don't think so. But the new people, they're gonna get them. Yeah, they're definitely gonna get some of that money, 100%.
Statistics can't tell us exactly who benefited from post-514 housing investments, but it can help show why Grady's concern matters. I took a look at some data for Census Tract 3302, where the Jefferson Avenue Tops is located, just to get a snapshot of life in the area before and after the mass shooting. It's a region with a 78% Black population, with nearly a third of its population living below the poverty level. Census Tract 3302 has remained largely renter-occupied over the past decade. As of 2024, the most recent year for which American Community Survey estimates are available, renters make up an estimated 61% of occupied housing units. The renter share appears to have grown since 2021 by about 4 percentage points, while the owner share declined. That shift doesn't prove that more homes are being bought up by investors, but it does add weight to concerns that, as new investment comes into the neighborhood, longtime Eastside residents may not be the ones best positioned to benefit from it. Mark Talley shared a similar concern.
That money's not going to help the people currently here. I believe, this is the start of the gentrification process. That money is going to help the residents that's going to be on the east side of Buffalo. It may not even be called the east side of Buffalo no more. It may be called something else, but it's going to help those residents when the ones that are currently there get kicked out of their homes because they can no longer afford to rent there.
Renter households actually have been under serious pressure. Both before and after the massacre, nearly half of all renters in Census Tract 3302 were rent-burdened. By 2024, more than a third were severely rent-burdened. That's important to note because several post-514 housing programs were framed around stabilization and wealth building, helping residents stay in their homes, repair their homes, or become homeowners. But in a neighborhood that remains majority renters, the question is whether those programs were enough to shift the conditions residents were already describing. The governor's website says that funding for all of the housing-related programs were exhausted, but there's no clear account on how many people have been helped overall. To get more specifics on how effective the governor's targeted investments have been, I filed several requests under New York State's Freedom of Information Law to different departments of state government. Both Empire State Development and the State of New York Mortgage Agency told me I should receive a response by late June. Of course, I'll be following up with what I find. Byron Brown said something poignant when he gave his witness statement at the congressional hearing, and while it was in relation to the mass shooting itself, it highlights a deeper-rooted issue, especially when considering what has or hasn't been done with 514 funding.
The May 14th shooting in Buffalo will impact an entire generation of children.
When the former mayor made this statement, he was speaking in policy terms. But on the ground, that impact is not abstract at all. For some Eastside residents, the harm that followed 514 cannot be separated from the violence young people were already living with, or from the way white supremacy, trauma, poverty, and public safety collide in neighborhoods like 14208. A key theme at the Ground Zero Speaks Forum was the impact of Buffalo's systems on young people, especially young people growing up with repeated exposure to violence, trauma, and disinvestment. Mercedes Overstreet, who leads the HEAT Youth Program, spoke about what happens when children and young adults on the East Side are forced to carry trauma without enough support. To her, the consequences are not theoretical. She said they show up in real time, in mental health struggles, in community violence, and in young people being left to survive problems they did not create.
So if you don't take in anything I'm saying, know that that same generation that was running to their guns, their ghost guns that can't be traced at the Juneteenth, they were running towards 14208 to get them. That's what white supremacy looked like. So when who's ever watching this, whoever thinking about this, ask yourself how you gonna handle white supremacy. You gonna keep tucking your tail or is you gonna support the youth that's genuinely being affected? Their mental health. Every single thing that the violence that's over here is directly impacted the youth. They kids dealing with adult trauma and not being helped by those that's supposed to help them. That's a problem, a huge problem.
Mental health funding is one area where we can see some concrete activity, even though measurable outcomes are harder to find. State and federal grants help fund culturally relevant wellness programs, psychological first aid training, and Best Self's Black Mental Health Response Team, which the state says treated more than 200 people and engaged nearly 1,000 others. Public funds also supported both early and current resiliency center models, with much of that money intended to expand mental health services for survivors, victims' families, and others directly impacted by the attack. But as we've heard, experiences varied among people who sought that care. The New York State Office of Victim Services also made nearly $3 million available to help victims' families and survivors access financial assistance and to help service providers access funding. But much of the public money tied to the crisis came with restrictions, something I'll get into shortly, which makes it harder to determine how much of the money was actually used, who received sustained care, and what outcomes were produced. There was also more direct aid with less red tape than some of the public funds. Black Love Resists in the Rust, a former grassroots collective led by Black and POC organizers, created an application process for $500 microgrants to help Black people in Buffalo access mental health services. Other philanthropic aid included part of Highmark's $300,000 investment, which supported behavioral health resources, as well as Buffalo Together grants that representatives say helped organizations providing mental health services to the community. But the larger picture is still incomplete. Public records often show what the money was supposed to do, but not always how many people received sustained care, how much was spent by service type, or whether the support was enough to meet the long-term trauma needs created by 514, especially when the eyes of the next generation are watching and measuring what was promised against what has actually changed. For Jackson, one of the young people who spoke at Ground Zero Speaks, the answer was clear.
I don't see the change. I feel like if we come together, the young and the old, if we come together, we could really make a bigger change. So that's my plea to my age groups. If y'all could get behind this, please do.
In my search for records, one request I was able to get fulfilled under the Federal Freedom of Information Act was a retrieval of records from the Department of Justice that showed awards to different agencies in response to the mass shooting. Erie County Medical Center received more than $400,000 to advance hospital-based victim services in 2022. The City of Buffalo receives two grants, one in 2023 and another in 2024, each over $200,000, to increase police patrols at select large-scale events to protect against terroristic threats and gun violence. And as previously discussed, the Community Health Center of Buffalo received nearly $4 million to operate a resiliency center. But the DOJ records add some new context. About 70% of those funds have not yet been drawn down, and the CHCB has until May 2027 to spend the remainder. As the center's chief operating officer, L. Hammonds, explained before, these are not in-hand funds. The roughly $1.1 million that have been drawn down reimbursed expenses related to establishing and operating the center. Still, I was curious to learn what the future holds for the Resiliency Center, especially with over $2.7 million still available.
I understand you said, you know, there's a time and a way in which these funds are administered. That's why they haven't all been spent yet. But I was just wondering, you know, what's left on your to-do list in terms of spending the remaining $2.7 million when you're able to be reimbursed for it, I should say. Like what?
First of all, we haven't spent, you know, the money we've spent, we've spent. The remaining money, like you said, roughly $2.7 million, whatever, I'm not quite sure if we're going to be able to spend all that money, because it's really money that's available to us. And as needs come up and as, you know, things come up, we'll use it. I can tell you for a fact, we're getting ready to enter into a heavy period of of court proceedings and testimony. So there's a lot that's getting ready to happen.
All right, so I guess my last question for you would be, you know, what are your plans moving forward? Do you see any new developments or expansions of the Resiliency Center that are immediately on the radar? Are there still things that you all hope to do? What comes next?
What's next and what's immediately in our focus is all of these court proceedings. They're about to begin and are beginning both nationally and locally and everything involved in that. There's a lot of support and need around what's getting ready to happen around court proceedings and testimonies and those types of things, everything that's getting ready to go through the court system for prosecution purposes or what have you. That's what's in our immediate focus. We really can't see beyond that at this point in time because it doesn't look like that's going to be a short term thing. It's going to last for a while. So we're preparing and gearing up to be a support and be there for what's coming up there.
Okay, so there were no sorts of, like, long-term targets you wanted to hit, like, you know, an idealized amount of staff or services you hope to provide or partnerships you want to explore, anything like that. Like, I was just wondering if you had a sort of goals list or things that you would like to, ways you'd like to see the Resiliency Center evolve.
Once again, like I've said, we get tremendous we're under tremendous oversight, and we're very restrictive in what we're able to script out based on the direction that we get from the Department of Justice. So, you know, to put together plans of staffing and programs and things like that and strategies and vision, we really don't have that kind of flexibility with the way these grant funds are allocated.
In the cases of both the CHCB's Resiliency Center and the African Heritage Food Co-op, we've seen how government funds, whether state or federal, come with conditions, and several factors can determine when, how, or even whether that money is actually disbursed. In some cases, money that isn't drawn down doesn't stay available forever. This will probably be a good time to make a few distinctions in the types of funding that composes this large pot of post-514 money. There's money that was promised. These are funds that were publicly announced to benefit specific individuals or causes in response to the shooting, but can be hard to track later. In some cases, I found that the documented amount did not exactly match the original pledge. One example is the previously mentioned pledge from HSBC Bank for $100,000, although the bank's actual documented gift was a quarter short of that. Then there's money that was awarded or contracted. This accounts for many of the public dollars awarded by government agencies to different causes and organizations. But those funds often come with very specific rules, timelines, and limits on how they can be spent. In the same vein is money that was drawn down or reimbursed from those awards and contracts. In simple terms, some grants don't work like a check handed over all at once. The money may be available, but the organization has to spend on approved expenses, submit documentation, and then drawn down or get reimbursed for those costs. So, awarded doesn't always mean the full amount has already been spent or received. One example, the Resource Council of Western New York's early contract as the initial candidate to run the state-funded Resiliency Center. The organization's executive director, Catherine Roberts, explained to me via email that the organization received an advance of $160,000 from the Office of Victim Services on September 14, 2022, just 11 days before the funds were set to expire. By the following January, just under $79,000 in unused funds were returned to OVS, while nearly $37,000 were approved for contract reimbursements related to staffing and victim services associated with the Jefferson Avenue site. Money tied to clear, visible deliverables is few and far in between, but there are some instances where funds put up could be traced back to where they were intended to go. Legacy 514's awarding of $5,000 scholarships to 10 students in 2023 is an example of funds landing into the hands of their intended recipients. Finally, and probably the most frustrating, is money with an unclear path. An example that comes to mind for me is a conversation I had with Ryan Brandenberger, a mortgage advisor in Florida with Buffalo ties. He and developer Brad Termini were publicly noted as having donated $50,000 to help cover funeral expenses for the 10 victims. But when I spoke with Ryan, he couldn't recall exactly who, corporate, he said, wrote that $50,000 check out to. Each of these money categories tells us something different. A promise, an award, a reimbursement, and a deliverable may all count toward the total, but they do not tell the same story about what actually reached the community. So when we're dealing with things like allocations instead of direct awards and organizational reimbursements instead of new money for expanded services, that paints a more complicated picture. At the beginning of the series, more than $90 million sounded like a lot. But when you realize not all of that money was actually dispersed or even meant to fund new services or programs, the pot starts to shrink. And maybe even more concerning, it suggests that the long-term investment promised to Buffalo's East Side and to the Black residents most harmed by the attack may have been smaller, more restricted, and less flexible than it first appeared. I brought that concern to someone who knows a lot more about the ins and outs of economics and finance than I do.
As an academic, let me be frank and honest. It is part of my research. Any researcher who researches in urban poverty or income inequality or any of the isms and this, we're kind of part of that. How many times have we heard of higher ed institutions targeting area X, area Y? They're going to come in and they're going to be part of the revitalization. Yeah. Outcome hasn't been that great. So I need to be frank. I'm part of this mechanism of, I don't want to coin it. I wouldn't say in my case profitability, but there's an exploitation. How do we reduce that? I don't think we can eliminate it. How do we reduce it? How do we align what we say we're going to do with what we do and align that with what the community needs? Because in the real world, the funder calls the shots. We feel your community needs X, Y, and Z. The community may go, okay, we really don't care for Z, but if we don't go along with this, we don't get X and Y. So, okay, but Z, I'm not really feeling Z, but Z is a part of this package here. Well, we'll take Z because we really need X and Y. It is a really incredibly nuanced world of incentives and disincentives that more times than not lead to low-income communities not benefiting significantly. I don't want to say there haven't been benefits. There has been. I think it's been random, hot luck. Certainly not systemic and sustainable.
So that makes me think then about my overarching question of where did the money go, which is what a lot of people are still asking as well, particularly members of the community. And even some survivors who say, hey, we were promised these services, why aren't we getting them? Did we see where the money went back in 2022 and early 2023 when, folks were giving out free fresh produce and counseling service and early helping, survivors with rental assistance and things of that nature? And now that those one-off gifts are starting to dwindle, organizations are limited in what they could do because it was all along to some extent temporary relief and not long-term investment. Although some of these organizations are promising long-term investment. But I guess to get back to my main question of, you know, is it that we've seen where the money's gone? Do you think that's a large part of it, that maybe because this was never supposed to happen, you know, this tragedy was never supposed to happen, we were never supposed to receive this money, but because we did, that's just what it was meant to address, the immediate 514 aftermath, and now we're sort of left where we were in terms of a community that's always been disinvested in?
We probably will never fully have an accounting of where and how the monies have been spent. The emotions outweigh the economics, and rightfully so. Right? That's not a criticism of the donors, but in those real-time moments, you may not ask questions you ask 2 years later. How is this going to be spent? Does this align with the needs of the community? What does accountability and transparency look like? In that real-time moment, those questions probably were not asked. And now, years later, being asked. Rightfully so. I would suspect we will never fully have a comfortable level of accountability and transparency. It's where we're at, unfortunately. But it, and I don't say that cavalierly, because that increases distrust. Right? There's a real opportunity cost to where we're at now. It increases distrust in communities that are already rightfully distrustful. Missed opportunities have a significant opportunity cost. Sometimes doing less is more until you can figure out what it is you're doing.
That distrust Rogers is talking about gets at something bigger than accounting. It also shows up in questions about who gets to decide what recovery should look like in the first place.
And I know what they're supposed to be doing for the community. And then now if they can't do these things for the community that they were supposed to do with the 514 money, they need to be held accountable. The Attorney General should be contacted, at least by someone. And on my behalf, I know that's something I have on the shelf to do.
To reach out to the Attorney General?
Absolutely. Accountability is everything. And today, now, you can't even trust, like, our government now. We're being told whatever we're being told. You know, and then if something affects you, you're going to work hard to get resolved. But now if you can't get a resolution, that would be okay. But at least you understand why a resolution hasn't occurred, right? So I just think that moving forward, I don't want to do no more memorials. I wanted some action. That's what I want.
Dolores isn't the only one asking for that kind of accountability. For Dominique Calhoun, those questions have moved beyond frustration and into legal action. She filed a petition in Erie County State Supreme Court on May 11th, just days before the fourth anniversary of 514, against Buffalo Together, along with two early stewards of its funds, the Community Foundation for Greater Buffalo and the United Way of Buffalo and Erie County. She's seeking a full accounting of the money raised by the fund and what measurable outcomes have been produced.
The leadership from the Buffalo Together Fund was here as well. And if any of you sat here during that meeting, what was told to us as we sat here was They gave all of the grants immediately out to the organization so that they can help with the needs of the community immediately. It was up to us to then contact these organizations to see what they were going to provide. And some of us, as myself, called around to see what services were going to be provided. You had, you know, business organizations. You had organizations for the youth. And for the most part, nobody provided any type of immediate assistance for anyone within the Jefferson community or the impacted victims. And it's really sad because, you know, you would think that unity would look like us coming together and building each other up and not being divided between who received funding and those that were not helped. But a conversation needs to be had.
Aaron Sakin, a partner at law firm Hodgson Russ LLP in Buffalo, is representing Buffalo Together, Inc. and the Community Foundation for Greater Buffalo as defendants. He sent me a statement via email May 15th, calling Dominique's lawsuit baseless, while echoing Garnell's stance that implementing the plan will take time and patience. He also added that all of the planning costs were covered separately. Dominique has since amended her petition from 15 pages to 52. An excerpt in response to Sakin's statement reads, "Transparency is not hostility. Accountability is not an attack. Asking for a full accounting of charitable funds raised after a nationally recognized tragedy is not baseless. It is a reasonable expectation from the very people whose trauma was used to inspire the donations in the first place." Dominique's petition puts the demand for accountability into legal terms, but outside the courtroom, that demand is much more personal for her and others. In my conversations with residents, survivors, and community members, accountability looked different depending on who I spoke to. I wanted to get a better sense of what healing could look like for a community first traumatized by racist terrorism, then re-traumatized by the feeling that it still hasn't received what it was owed. So I asked people, plainly, what does accountability look like to you?
To me, making it right means restoring what was taken, repairing what was damaged, and investing in a community that should have been invested long before 514. So I would say, number one, you have to directly invest into the people who were harmed. And I'm not necessarily talking about people who were in Tops that day, but people who still have to live on Jefferson, Riley, all the side streets, people who heard the gun violence that day and saw the ambulance and the FBI and the police taking people out of Tops that day. You have to invest in them.
I think all of the people who benefited from the 514 through resources should meet here at the Meriwether Library on a designated day. All the foundations, all of anybody who received anything from the 514 and resources should meet so we can all know who we all are. And let's start the conversation. That would be a good start.
But yeah, just be more precise of who you're giving the money to. I mean, it's so vague and open, it's a trick. So yeah, this is an African-American fund. The people that were attacked because of their skin color and the beliefs y'all done pushed on people. He learned this in a year during COVID. Oh yeah, let's make sure we give it to them.
There are a few answers to the question of where did the money go. Unfortunately, none of them are satisfying or definitive. Donations made to funds were given to victims' families, survivors, and organizations. But it's possible that not everyone who may have been eligible on paper received what they were entitled to. Different levels of government offered support as well, but many of those large figures that were announced in press conferences and releases weren't dollars that actually reached the city. They are often tied to specific criteria, restrictions, and timelines, and in some cases, subject to being returned if time or circumstances did not allow them to be spent. Many nonprofits receive direct financial aid, but widely, within the context for covering services and resources already used in the aftermath of the shooting, not necessarily to create new avenues of relief for residents. For some organizations, providing a direct accounting or ledger is complicated, maybe too complicated to fully capture on paper.
Some funds promised publicly were reduced, difficult to verify, or in some cases, not given at all. There are still millions of dollars being held for so-called long-term investments, but many of the people who still need help say they'd rather see the money invested into the community right now. With calls for investigations on the horizon, more may be revealed over time. But the task of following the money doesn't end here. Not for me, or for the victims, survivors, and community members seeking answers. This concludes Where Did the Money Go? A What's Next special. But the search for accountability will continue. For BTPM NPR, I'm Ijaz Jasil. Thank you for listening
to BTPM NPR WBFO and WBFO HD1 Buffalo, WOLN Olean, and WUBJ Jamestown, a service of Buffalo Toronto Public Media.
Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.